From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now. The nationwide shortage of baby formula is vaulting to the top of lawmakers' to-do lists. This morning, Democrats on the House Oversight Committee announced they'd look into it.
Let's talk about this, along with abortion and January 6th, with our Friday Politics Roundtable. Sahil Kapoor is Senior National Political Reporter for NBC News. Hi, Sahil.
Hi. It's great to be back.
Good to have you back. Chad Pergram is congressional correspondent for Fox News. Chad, hi, happy Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about baby formula. It is hard to find because of supply chain and recall issues, and Republicans are blaming the White House. Let's listen to Kathy McMorris Rogers, congresswoman from Washington State.
Moms, support groups, nurses have been telling me that this is the biggest crisis that they have faced. President Biden and the FDA must do more. This is a matter of life or death. What will it take for the Biden administration to reverse its inflation, supply chain, and energy crises that are making the shortage worse?
Now, the White House is scrambling. It's meeting with producers and retailers, is trying to cut red tape to import more. But Sahil, does it surprise you that this has become a big political issue?
Not at all. This has turned into quite the mini crisis for the Biden administration, and it's emblematic of his presidency so far, where one economic issue after another has been thrown at him. There was inflation, the supply chain problems. It ties into these kitchen table issues that voters are primarily focused on. And the problem the president has is that there's no easy fix-it button here. Yes, they're talking to retailers. Yes, the FDA is looking to change policy, you know, for raising imports of infant formula. The Department of Agriculture is also encouraging states to allow WIC benefits, women, infant, and children benefits to be used for this. They're even talking about using the Defense Production Act to create more of this. It's an all-hands-on-deck approach, so the White House says, but there's no easy way to fix it. And the Republican response you played is also emblematic of what we've seen so far. They have tried to seize on these economic and kitchen table issues to damage the president politically, but I didn't hear a proposed solution there from Congresswoman McMorris Rogers. It's not easy to simply reverse inflation. It's not easy to simply fix supply chain problems. So Republicans have been short on solutions, but they have been quite aggressive in blaming the president and his party, which does control the House and the Senate, for economic problems around the country.
Well, and for his part, President Biden has blamed Trump supporters for some of these economic issues. Let's listen.
Believe me, I understand the frustration. But the fact is, congressional Republicans, not all of them, but the mega Republicans are counting on you to be as frustrated by the pace of progress, which they have everything, they've done everything they can to slow down.
Chad, he is the president. Doesn't Joe Biden own this economy right now and these issues?
The voters certainly think that he does. I mean, that's an issue that Republicans are highlighting there. And every time you have one of these economic crises come up, as Sahil talked about, you're going to have Republicans jump on President Biden and say, oh, look, it's gas prices. Oh, look, it's inflation. It's the economy. It's baby formula. Anything they can drive down on that. And they point out, what were most of the Democrats at the Capitol today focused on? Abortion. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, had a big rally. That certainly stokes their base there. But there's been criticism that the president and his administration was asleep at the switch on this. I just talked to Raja Krishnamoorthy, the Democratic congressman from Illinois, who's written a letter to the FDA, along with Carolyn Maloney of New York City, the chair of the Oversight Committee, you know, trying to get to the bottom of this. There's a hearing that's coming up in late May. But the problem is that's a couple weeks from now, you know, and voters are going to say, what are you doing right now? It's the price of meat. It's the price of gas. We can't find formula. It is these basic bread and butter issues that continue to trip up this administration.
All right. And Chad, on the abortion issue, you mentioned Democrats in the Senate this week tried and failed to pass a measure to make abortion legal nationwide. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell spoke to NPR about how the expected decision soon from the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade may be out of step with public opinion.
So for the Supreme Court to, on any issue, to reach a decision contrary to public opinion is exactly what the Supreme Court is about. It's to protect basic rights, even when majorities are in favor of something else. It happens all the time.
Chad, that may be true, but majorities matter at the polls, don't they?
They matter at the polls here, and this is where Mitch McConnell, in that interview, you know, he talked about a flag-burning case back from the late 80s, which if you talk to 70-80% of the public, they were opposed to burning flags, but the Supreme Court back then said that this was a First Amendment issue. But here's the problem on this for Democrats. They have said, hey, you know, we are the party of pro-choice. Bob Casey, the Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, who heretofore had been mostly pro-choice, voted on this procedural motion just the other day. They couldn't even get 50 votes on their side. Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, was a no. The vote was 49-51. And the bigger problem here is that you hear from the left sometimes, oh, you have to change the filibuster. You have to turn off the filibuster. Well, that needs 60 votes. You know, you have to turn off a filibuster. You need a simple majority if you're going to do one of these, what they call on Capitol Hill, a nuclear option. You can't even get to 51 votes on this issue, let alone, get 51 votes for a filibuster. The Democrats don't have the math on this to work on their side right now, even though they might have the issue with, 70% of the population. Hmm.
Well, let's move to the House committee investigating the January 6th riots at the Capitol. In a rare move, they subpoenaed five fellow members of Congress, including the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, which in any other time would be extraordinary, Sahil. What did you make of this 1 month out from these public hearings?
Oh, it's still extraordinary. It's still unprecedented. The fact that they subpoenaed five members of Congress, including the House Minority Leader, is quite extraordinary for this moment. Now, the committee has been at odds about whether to take this step. There have been some advocating for it for quite some time, but there has been a reluctance. It is an unprecedented move for an oversight committee to subpoena sitting members of Congress. But the conclusion that this committee made was that this investigation is an extraordinarily unique type of thing. It's about an attempted insurrection on the United States Capitol, part of a plot to overturn the 2020 presidential election. And if they didn't do this, it's difficult to look back on this investigation and say they tried everything they could to get to the truth, which has been their mission. The five Republicans, of course, are Kevin McCarthy, as well as Jim Jordan, Scott Perry, Mo Brooks, Andy Biggs. And with McCarthy in particular, there's a phone call he had with then-President Trump on January 6th, which was believed to be quite heated. It's still not clear what exactly was said. These are two very senior leaders of the party, and it falls squarely within the scope of this investigation to try to get answers on that. That is the theory of this committee for doing so. Now, one of the reasons that the committee had been reluctant to do this is that it would set a precedent. Future majorities could also subpoena sitting members of Congress. What do they do if they don't comply? Are they going to ask the Justice Department to prosecute a sitting member of Congress for contempt of Congress? That would be another extraordinary step. But this is the decision they've taken now. And one of the coming off the House floor, I tried to ask Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy whether he believes, if he refuses to comply with the subpoena, whether Democrats next year, should he be Speaker, should his party be in the majority and issue subpoenas, whether he expects Democrats to comply. This could set a precedent two ways if these Republicans refuse to cooperate.
Chad, you cover the Hill. Your thoughts on this?
Well, the problem here is that Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution says that the House and Senate have the right to discipline their own members. So if this goes to court or they send a criminal referral down to the DOJ, if they vote to hold them in contempt of Congress for not actually complying with the subpoena, they're going to say, wait a minute, legislative branch under Article 1 can take care of its own business. You also have what's called the speech or debate clause, where there's kind of a shield there for members of Congress looking into their actual congressional doings. So that's a problem. The other issue, though, is that this sets the table for these big hearings that'll start in around June 9th or so is what we're told here. And the idea that they still may actually ask these members to come and testify. And if they don't, there's a lot of stagecraft here. You could imagine a scenario where they put the nameplates out of each of the witnesses, Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Brooks. They have an empty chair there. They have the glass with the water beads of on the glass there. And they create this narrative. And then they bring up a witness or evidence or something that say, hey, you knew about this. And they're not here to answer those questions. And some of those hearings are going to be televised. Some of those hearings are going to be in prime time. So what they're really doing here is priming the pump for those hearings in June. Hmm.
Well, before we wrap up here, I want to ask you both about Tuesday's Pennsylvania Senate primary. We have an unexpected surge on the Republican side by Kathy Barnett, a relative unknown. Here's a campaign video where her mother says she was pregnant with Kathy as a result of rape.
I don't want to use the word choice. She was going to be born. I didn't have a choice to say, you're going to live or I'm going to abort you. That wasn't a choice for me. And I thank God it wasn't a choice for me.
Sahil, what does this rise tell us about the Republican Party? About 30 seconds here.
Well, it shows the field is still unsettled. A Fox News poll that came out just a few days ago found a three-way race between the Trump-endorsed candidate Mehmet Oz, David McCormick, and now Kathy Barnett is right up there, and she is surging just at the right time. It shows that the other two candidates had not locked this up, neither of them, and Barnett has won a lot of anti-abortion voters, pro-life voters, with this argument. It kind of captures a lot of what the conversation in Washington has been with the expected fall of Roe versus Wade, and there is a strain of thinking that there should not be exceptions for rape and incest. And here we have Kathy Barnett, a candidate for Senate, speaking very directly to that. Remains to be seen how this will turn out on Tuesday.
Thanks, Sahil Kapoor of NBC News, Chad Pergram for Fox News. Thank you.
The Supreme Court is prepared to revoke abortion rights and upend nearly 50 years of legal precedent dating back to the landmark 1973 case Roe v. Wade. But the history of abortion rights goes back much further and is more complicated than the court's draft opinion suggests. For more, we're joined now by Leslie Regan. She's a history professor at the University of Illinois and author of When Abortion Was a Crime: Women, Medicine, and Law in the United States. Professor, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Justice Samuel Alito devotes a good chunk of his draft opinion to the legal history of abortion in the United States. He writes, quote, "An unbroken tradition of prohibiting abortion on pain of criminal punishment persisted from the earliest days of the common law until 1973. Is that accurate?
This is a very selective reading of the history and the way statutes were written. Alito also says very carefully, at least at some point during pregnancy, it was a crime. And then in a footnote, we'll just ignore this discussion about quickening.
So tell us what fetal quickening is.
Quickening is when a woman feels movement inside of her. Fetal movement, we might call it kicking. And that moment of quickening is what mattered morally and legally and emotionally, because at that point, it was then considered a life and it was a crime in common law to abort at that point.
So it was after this fetal quickening that abortion was considered against the law and in many cases considered immoral, but it was always left to the woman to make that determination.
Yeah, quickening is determined by the woman herself. It's her own body and she recognizes it. Prior to that, it's not regulated by the state. There are cases that are thrown out, you know, in this very early period because the judge says she wasn't quick with child. So Alito had to avoid that and say, yeah, at some point, which is late pregnancy, post-quickening, that was against the law. But prior to that, it wasn't.
In the Roe versus Wade opinion in 1973, Justice Harry Blackmun writes that for the first 100 years of this country's history, abortions were legal in most states. So when and why was there a shift? Explain to us historically when that happened and why.
The laws that criminalize abortion from conception on are passed in every state in the 1860s and 1870s. And this follows a campaign led by a very small group of elite physicians, and particularly Dr. Horatio Storer, who was a Harvard professor and specialist in gynecology and obstetrics. I mean, abortion referred to post-quickening. They began to define abortion as the entire time of pregnancy and really equate it to infanticide. And they pushed a kind of a model law, you know, the individual medical societies around the states, and these got passed. Storer's reasons were framed with scientific data that was incorrect, by the way. But the things he says make it clear that what mattered was a demographic issue and basically white middle-class Yankee women not having enough babies and not doing their duty to their family, to womanhood, and to the nation. There are racist undertones, concerns about immigrants, and then it's very anti-feminist at its core as well.
Of course, even after abortion was made illegal in many states, they continued to happen, and yes, many women were forced to seek abortions that were unsafe. I want to play a clip from one woman describing her backroom abortion. This is from an episode of the NPR Politics podcast, and a warning, it is graphic.
The best way I can describe it would be the equivalent of having a hot poker stuck up into your uterus and scraping the walls with that. It was excruciatingly painful. The attendant that was there held me down on the table. I must say he worked on me more as though I were literally a piece of meat, and I don't mean that to be vindictive, but that was the way the relationship was.
Professor, what stories have you heard as an historian of abortion rights? What was the reality for women when abortion was illegal?
Well, that clip is certainly one of them. You know, when it's illegal, people are still going to get abortions. There were women who had abortions like that. There were women who were harassed and sexually assaulted during their abortion. And then there were also people who went to very good practitioners, people who were very skilled and, you know, by this time, 50s, 60s, use anesthesia and antibiotics. So it's such a mix of people's experiences. So it's very scary and risky to go get an abortion. And people felt like they were turned into criminals, people who were, you know, obeyed the law all the time in their daily life. And so that's something I've heard that really stayed with people.
But what do you say to opponents of abortion rights who look forward to Roe being overturned, people who say this is about the rights of an unborn baby, and they supersede the right of a pregnant woman to choose?
You know, I think people can have those beliefs, but not everybody shares that belief. And we have religious pluralism in this country. So I do see this as rooted in religious values being placed on everybody. But the other part of it is, I think there's an assumption that it was always immoral and wrong, and it's only until the 1960s that changed, or the pill or something. And, you know, what I found is, in my research, there really was a strong sense among women that this was a right that they had. This was a decision they could make. And they really didn't question it when they needed to go find a way to end a pregnancy for various reasons. And plenty of their husbands and boyfriends and men in their lives thought the same way. There's a long tradition of accepting abortion and comprehending the many different reasons that bring women to that point.
Well, and there are many others who will say that, you know, we live in a different time now. Birth control is widely available, that there's no need for an abortion because there shouldn't be any unwanted pregnancies.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an optimistic and mythical view of reality. We know quite well that not everyone can successfully use contraceptives all the time. We also know that people are sexually assaulted and may end up pregnant as a result. The people who are most opposed to sex education and making contraceptives available are the same people who are working so hard to criminalize abortion. And they say end abortion. And they can't end abortion. What they can do is make it unsafe and make specific groups very vulnerable. Teenagers, women of color, poor people, trans, they're the ones who will have a harder time finding a safe way to end a pregnancy.
That's Leslie Regan, professor of history at the University of Illinois and author of When Abortion Was a Crime, Women, Medicine, and Law in the United States. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, people across the country are contemplating an uncertain future for abortion and its legality. That includes young people. YR Media's Miranda Zanka goes to college in Illinois, and she's thinking about it, which she says has been a surreal experience.
The first thing my mom taught me about sex when I was 7 or 8 was that it leads to pregnancy. As soon as she started talking, I regretted asking the question. I did what any kid would have done and tried to cover my ears and sing over her voice. Thankfully, my mom is a patient woman, and she calmly waited until I was ready to listen to what she had to say. She explained everything in a very scientific way, and I was absolutely shocked to learn that this is how babies were made. When I got into high school, she reminded me constantly that there was never a good excuse to have unprotected sex. And if a guy didn't want to use a condom, he wasn't the right guy for me. When I got into my first serious relationship, my mom was the one who took me to get an IUD. It wasn't until recently that I realized how lucky I am to have been brought up this way. On the morning of Monday, May 2nd, I got a text from my friends. "So it's looking like the Supreme Court might overturn Roe v. Wade." I looked over my cereal bowl and felt sick, angry, and scared. I was kind of angry with myself. For the past few weeks, I'd been so concerned about my own problems, like final exams and tips at work and what to wear to parties. I forgot what the world looked like outside of my own bubble. It was much uglier. I thought back to high school. I remembered the girls I knew who had to get Plan B without telling their moms. The girls who had to have birth control prescriptions mailed to a friend's house because they couldn't ask their parents. The girl who was rumored to have had an abortion and was demonized when she came back to school. To think that those young women felt guilty and ashamed for taking care of their sexual health is so upsetting to me. I always seem to forget that people weren't raised with the same support and education I had. On a larger scale, I realize that I've never had to worry about access to reproductive health care services because of my state. Illinois' policies protect a woman's right to choose. Now it seems like that security is up in the air, something I never imagined would happen. Even after final exams have ended and dorm rooms have been packed up, I still haven't felt the sense of relief that the promise of summer usually brings. I wish I could ask my mom what's going to happen and she could give me an answer. I wish she could tell me that I have nothing to worry about, but she doesn't have an easy explanation, and now I'm old enough to realize that even my mom can't protect me from whatever lies ahead.
That was 18-year-old Miranda Zanka, who is a college student in Illinois. Her essay was produced by YR Media, a national network of young journalists and artists.
Parents who've been dealing with the baby formula shortage are facing the prospect that it could last 4 months. One mother, Chloe Banks, told NPR this week how hard it is to find formula for her 11-month-old son, Teddy.
It's incredibly stressful. It's endless where you don't know where, you know, your next can of formula is going to come from.
The Biden administration is looking at a number of options, including using the Defense Production Act to increase supplies, and Congress is planning a hearing later this month. Mike Regan joins us now to talk about it. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, 43% of baby formula was sold out at stores across the country. The big question that desperate parents are asking right now is, what are manufacturers or the government doing to help them find formula for their babies?
Well, the White House has been in discussion with various manufacturers, and the companies have promised to continue to step up production in the coming weeks. And to some degree, that's already started. The White House officials have said that more infant formula was produced in the last 4 weeks than in the 4 weeks before the recall by Abbott Labs, which is really the main source of this problem, that big recall in February. And the FDA has also said in coming days it would announce new steps that should speed imports of formula from countries like Mexico and Chile, Ireland and the Netherlands. And they also are going to announce plans to sort of add some flexibility for domestic producers to produce more. So a lot's being done, but obviously still a pretty critical issue.
You mentioned the recall back in February. The Abbott Laboratory factory in Michigan shut down because of contamination. Why isn't that plant up and running again so many months later?
Well, the FDA is coming under a lot of criticism because, for one thing, they were alerted about the problem with the Minnesota plant way back in September. And they didn't get around to inspecting the plant till February. And that's when the recall was issued and the plant was shut down. Now, Abbott Labs has said they would be able to open the plant again in about 2 weeks after getting FDA approval to do so. So they're waiting on that. And the FDA, for its part, has said it's trying to speed up that process to get them approval. But obviously, there's a lot of regulations and paperwork that needs to be done for this type of thing. So it's really taking longer, I think, than most people would want.
Right. And so if President Biden invokes the Defense Production Act, which gives him power to tell companies what to produce, is it a viable option? I mean, can a company spin up another plant to make formula so quickly that, you know, it meets all these stringent FDA guidelines?
It's something that he's under some pressure to do. There are lawmakers in his own party really pounding the table about that issue. And it may or may not. I think, you know, the companies are doing as much as they can already. And given the how highly regulated this product is, it's really tough to just sort of turn on a new factory overnight or expand production too much and do it in the right way. So it's something he's likely going to consider and study, but it's hard to say whether or not it will provide an immediate solution.
Mm. Well, we're hearing from milk banks around the country getting a surge of calls from desperate parents looking for help. Thanks for this information, Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Really appreciate it, Mike.
Thank you, Jane.
The Forbidden City is the old imperial palace in Beijing, and it's the name of a new novel. Chinese-American author Vanessa Hua writes about a teenage girl in the 1960s plucked from her village to serve the head of the Communist Party, Chairman Mao Zedong, and she reveres the chairman. And then things get complicated. She becomes the chairman's protege, lover, and political pawn during a nationwide crackdown known as the Cultural Revolution. And she winds up, well, you got to read it. Vanessa Hua is on Skype to talk about Forbidden City. Vanessa, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me on, Scott.
So your protagonist is fascinating. Mei Xiang was raised in the countryside in China and plucked in the early 1960s to do what? Tell us about her.
A party official arrives and she's selected for a mysterious duty in the capital. And it's not until she gets there that she understands she's to serve the chairman in a dance troupe because he's a fan of ballroom dancing.
Which is true, right? I mean, that part of your research, you actually learn that Chairman Mao was a dancer, was a bad dancer. Yeah?
Yes. The American journalist Agnes Smedley in 1937 traveled to Yan'an, the rebel stronghold, and taught Mao and other top leaders foxtrot, square dancing. And of Mao, she said he had no rhythm in his being.
Okay, we're not going to give the whole story away, of course, but when your main character, Mei, goes to Beijing, there's a whole lot of palace intrigue. Tell us a little about that.
She's idealistic. She's young. She's always wanted to serve the revolution and the party in some way. But when she gets there, she's immediately caught up in the court intrigues, not only with the other young women in the dance troupe, but also has to face down the madam, the chairman's wife, and other political leaders who might see her as a way to get to the chairman. And she finds a way through. She's a survivor, but of course, survival comes at a cost.
Yeah. And you decided to write this novel in the past tense of an older woman looking back with some regret at this chapter in her life and the trade-off she's made, the lives she's impacted. Of course, the Cultural Revolution was a type of hell for most people in China at the time. Why do you take the perspective of looking back to tell the story?
The retrospective narrator allowed me to, on one hand, show her youthful idealism, but also that journey to disillusionment. So Mei is someone who's grown up revering the chairman, believes this man is a god. And yet when she's in his inner circle, reality bumps up against what she's been raised to believe. And the novel opens on the day of the chairman's death in 1976. That's what allows her to consider these painful memories that she had buried for so long. And it's a real reckoning.
Yeah. Well, you know, you spent a fair amount of time in China, as did I. And when I was asking some of my relatives about this, my aunt, and she was a member of the Red Guard, these fanatical students who attacked their teachers and their parents and anyone considered, you know, impure politically. She said, you know, we don't talk about this a lot because we are ashamed of what we did. I mean, do you think the pain looking back in this novel as a way of representing millions of people in China who still carry these scars?
Oh, completely. because neighbors turned on neighbors, students on teachers. Sometimes in the name of revolution, they were settling petty grievances and taking revenge. And to fully face it is difficult. And also to go against Mao would be to go against the very foundation of the country. So it's very difficult to face what someone might have done on a personal level, but on a national level as well.
Yeah. Tell us about the start. What inspired, hey, I'm going to talk about a young woman who was on the inside when Mao returns to power in China and he sets off this horrific cultural revolution?
Well, I was inspired by a photo I saw. This was about a decade and a half ago now. I was watching a documentary and up pops a photo of Chairman Mao surrounded by giggling teenage girls. And I was completely astonished. And that's when I learned that he had these dance troops that some of them went on to become his companions. They had titles such as confidential clerk or nurse. They would handle his correspondence. People had to go through them to get to Mao. The chairman's physician, Li Zhishui, has a famous memoir in which he references them and says, oh, it must have been the most exhilarating, exciting experience of their lives. And I knew it had to be more complicated than that.
Sure.
And,
yep.
Yeah. And that's really where it began.
Yeah. And of course, many Americans far away have at least heard of the Cultural Revolution in China, 1966 to 1976. What did you learn about it in the course of writing this? And what do you want the readers to take away from that nightmare decade in China?
I learned that the roots of it began in the Great Leap Forward a couple of years earlier, that Mao's attempt to rapidly industrialize and become a leader of the communist world resulted in famine for, you know, millions. And as we arrive on the eve of the Cultural Revolution, Mao was worried about his legacy. And all his handpicked successors, he began to see as rivals that he wanted to take down. And in writing May and making her my main character, she's emblematic of those many impoverished young women around the world, not just in China, who've shaped history in their own way, yet don't even merit a footnote in official accounts.
Yeah. Now, you're like me, a journalist who has covered China a lot and the Chinese diaspora. What about your journalism experience helped you report this story, tell this story?
I think it helped me in a number of ways, not only in the research I did, ferreting out the footnotes, going to China and tracing the path that would be May's, or writing about young women who left their homes in the countryside to work in factories, giving up everything they'd ever known, their family, in order to seek opportunity and a life different from the one handed down to them. So that inspired, in part, the character of May.
And let me ask you about the subject matter. And I wonder if, given your background, which is very similar to mine, whether there's anything that is personal here. My enduring recollection of a Cultural Revolution story is my uncle. My dad got out of China. His younger brother didn't. And I spent hours with him in Shanghai asking him about the Cultural Revolution. And he said his mother was a teacher. She was attacked in this period in the late 60s. And she was made to stand in the winter under a tree. She had to bow down and the icicles would drip down the back of her neck for hours. I mean, that's the image that stays with me. Obviously, a lot more horrific things happened in the Cultural Revolution. But is there any of this that is connected to you? Your story, your family story.
Yes. And thank you for sharing that important, horrific personal history of your family. So I'm the American-born daughter of Chinese immigrants who were born in the 1930s, grew up in a childhood marked by war with the Japanese and then the Civil War. And as the communists came to power, they fled to Taiwan and eventually made their way to the U.S. as grad students. And they didn't talk much about the past, preferring to focus on the future. And in fact, it wasn't until I was adult that I learned that part of my extended family was brutally impacted by the Cultural Revolution. One fact was about how their home had been taken away and they were crammed into a much smaller space, and there weren't many details forthcoming. And I felt it was so important to explore this chapter of Chinese history that continues to resonate today, that continues to impact, you know, how the country might reckon with itself or not. And I'm haunted by the thought of, you know, neighbors living alongside neighbors. They know what atrocities were committed against them, and yet they don't speak of it. And, you know, what does that do to a family or to a society?
Vanessa Hua is the author of the novel Forbidden City, which is out this week, and we will have an excerpt of that at hereandnow.org. Vanessa Hua, thank you. Congratulations.
Thanks so much for having me on.
A beloved TV character is getting a new face.
I'm the Doctor.
I'm the Doctor.
I'm the Doctor.
I'm the Doctor.
Yes, the Doctor from the BBC show Doctor Who. And just FYI, as I'm catching up to this myself, the Doctor is a time traveler and an alien who has been played as a lead character by 13 different actors since the 1960s. Number 14 will be Shuti Gatwa, taking up residence in a time machine known as the TARDIS. Gatwa will be the first person of color to play the lead since the show began six decades ago, at least by our traditional earthly measure of time. Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, is with us. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
So for those of us unfamiliar with the show, and check me on this, the Doctor is an alien who travels through time to solve the problems of the universe, I gather, and every so often gets a new appearance and a new personality. I guess the word is regenerates.
Yep.
And now we get Shuti Gatwa, black man. Eric, what took the show producers so long to get here?
I wish I could tell you, because there have been, you know, fans, of course, have been advocating and hoping to see a non-white doctor for a long time. Now, technically, there has been a non-white version of the character. It just wasn't the lead of the show.
Okay.
But the thing that's interesting about Doctor Who is that the Doctor dies every so often and then regenerates, and it's an excuse to switch out the actors.
Oh, just like we get a new James Bond every few years.
Well, you know, it's different than that because the stories continue.
Oh, I see.
It is the same entity.
With the same memory.
It's a really a mind-bending concept if you haven't seen the show, but it allows the show to constantly renew and refresh itself,
okay,
which I really love.
So now, this upcoming season, we will get Shuti Gatwa. He's Rwandan-Scottish, 29 years old, currently on the show Sex Education on Netflix, and he plays the lead's best friend.
This is a new frontier, my sexually repressed friends. Our chance to finally move up the social food chain. We shall transform from lowly caterpillars into awesome killer whales.
So what do you think, Eric? What will he bring to the show as the new Doctor?
Well, you know, it's always tough to know. I mean, what we do know is that he's a great actor. We know that he's great at handling comedy and drama, which he's had to sort of straddle in his role in Sex Education. But a lot of that question is up to the writers. What are they wanting to explore? There was a sense that for a time they wanted a younger doctor who could have a little more, you know, romantic appeal. And so that's why we got doctors like David Tennant and Matt Smith. Mm-hmm. And then they wanted to explore what it was like to have an older doctor. And then we had a female doctor. And, you know, frankly, one of the things for me about Doctor Who is I don't think they ever really adequately explored what it was like to have a character that was male suddenly become female. And so I'm hoping that this casting choice means that they're actually going to lean into exploring the blackness of the character.
Uh-huh.
Will they also have a little bit of fun with the presumed sexuality of the character or gender of the character? But what's interesting to me about the Doctor is it's always been Doctor Who, the show, has always been, it's always straddled this line between being a kid's show and being a science fiction show that grown-ups could enjoy. So even though they've cast a black man in this role, how will they explore all these interesting identity things that they have access to now, but also sort of maintain the show's history as a show that's a science fiction show that kids can enjoy. It'd be interesting to see them walk that line.
Now, Eric, as you've been telling us, Jodie Whittaker is the first woman to play the Doctor in this current season. The show didn't make a huge deal of it, didn't really dwell on what the Doctor looked like. How do you think this upcoming season is going to handle the transition to a black man as the Doctor?
Well, it's interesting because it might sound silly to some people who would say, you know, it's a science fiction show. And he's playing an alien that, you know, is, you know, 2,000 years old or something. You know, why are we worried about something like race or something like gender? But the show has always kind of talked a little bit about gender and about, you know, generational age. And now I'm wondering, is it ready to interrogate race a little bit?
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that they will not use that, the science fiction of it all, to avoid the conversations about culture and race that they could have by having, you know, this character suddenly be black. You know, I'm hoping that they'll be willing to interrogate the idea that, you know, this doctor cannot go that far back into Britain's past, for example, without encountering some serious roadblocks in terms of how he would be treated versus how, you know, the white people in his entourage might be treated. So it could be really, really interesting if they're willing to lean into it, and we will see.
Eric Deggans is NPR TV critic. Eric, thanks for the time as always. Happy watching. Have a good weekend.
All right. Good luck catching up. There's a whole lot of episodes for you to go through, my friend.
We will begin. Take care. By the way, Jane, I'll be binging. What are you going to be watching this weekend?
Well, I confess I'm a little behind. I was going to finish up Bridgerton this weekend, but I may have to pivot to Doctor Who. Sounds like there are a lot of episodes. Thanks for the heads up, Scott. And whatever you're watching, have a good weekend, everyone. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.